Okay, gotta think of smart things to say. Okay. Robots. Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and with me today are John.
Hello.
And Andy.
Hey.
How's it going, guys?
It's all right. Could be better. Could be worse.
It's a Saturday and we're talking about anime. I think it's the best possible world.
I've been speaking about anime all day.
Right.
Just come back from a con in Chester. So yeah, that was fun.
You want to do some plugging? You can do plugging right now. We're looking for sponsors.
Sure. My girlfriend's website is moongarage.co.uk, and you can check it out. And it's pretty good. She's a very talented artist. She'll hate me because she'll hear this, and then she'll want to rip my throat out. But it's okay, because she'll be happy for the plug.
I'm sorry, Andy's girlfriend. You can blame it all on me. I asked.
That's true.
Anyway. So, who's been watching something good? We're going to start with good stuff first and go to bad stuff later, and that's me, because I've been watching crap.
Yeah, I'll go first then. The last episode of JoJo Bizarre Adventure, Stardust Crusaders, has ended yesterday, and it was fantastic. It was really, really
fantastic.
Good. Yeah. I mean, I'm a tad biased, because I am a big fan of JoJo. I think I led up to the sixth arc. The sixth arc of the manga, and then when the anime was, like, I was sold it by my girlfriend as this is something that will never be released as an anime again, because basically the third season is the most popular of them all, and then it'll just never turn into an anime. And then when the 25th year of JoJo came around and they released the first season, I was like really excited. And then the first season did the show more than justice. It was a beautiful thing, and then it got better and better, and the third season is honestly like really, really fucking good. I absolutely love it. Like, it's got everything down, I think, that I love about JoJo. The stupidness, the weirdness, the art style, like how Hirohiko Arakai's sort of art and color changes every now and then. Like, if you ever look at any of his color pictures, like, none of the colors are ever sort of uniform. They're always like these crazy sort of mismatched styles, and they did that really good big justice, especially with stuff like Dio and in his last stand. I don't want to ruin it. Can I ruin it? I mean, it's Dio. Everyone knows his last stand, right?
I actually didn't. That was a surprise to me. But I have finished it now, so now I know what it is. But I'm just saying, there might be other people.
Well, I'm planning to watch it someday, because I'm an awful pervert who waits until anime is done airing before I usually start watching it. But I'm aware. I think almost anybody who's reasonably plugged into the anime shonen or like trans shonen scene is like aware of who Dio is. At the very least, like AMV Hell has their fifth movie is dedicated to Dio, as it were. But yeah, like I kind of want you to go and like, cause most of what I know about JoJo, and this is with me having watched the first season of the new version, is how incredibly like over the top and kind of like gleefully homoerotic in a way that I only really know about through like hard gay and Japanese live action comedy. Is that what's appealing about JoJo, like in a more sophisticated and in-depth sense, or is there something else that you can offer to me as an explanation of what is JoJo and why do people just like post all over my Facebook feed about JoJo's Bizarre Adventure and oh my god JoJo?
I mean, certainly the homoerotica sort of element is really enjoyable. There's also just like stands. When you get to the third arc, it introduces stands. So the first two, there's a power called Hamon, which is sort of like a breathing technique where you can breathe, and then using breathe, you use the essence of life or something, and that kills people. But then it gets to...
It's essentially the power of the sun.
Yes, sorry, like... that's right. Yeah, power of the sun condensed, and...
Get your JoJo lore correct.
I don't know if that's what they actually call it, but it's like it has the same effect on a vampire, which is what Dio is.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. And then
to explain to people, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is a decades long saga of a family who fights against these vampires and also like Mayan gods, kind of.
Sure.
just to help with the people who hear JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. And when I heard it, I envisioned something like One Piece. And it actually shares weird stuff with One Piece, mostly because of genre concerns. But yeah, I don't think of it as this like quasi-serious, like male fighting thing going on with Nazis. And
yeah, I mean, what I really like about JoJo is so every arc is quite separate from itself. The first and the second arc and the third arc follow each other on quite closely. But then from the fourth arc onwards, it sort of does its own thing, and so JoJo is not one person. It's whatever the current arc's JoJo is the name of, like, so the first one's called Joseph, then Jonathan, then Josuke, then no Jotaro, then Josuke, then Jolene.
Jotaro. Yeah.
And then there's two in arc six, which is Gio and someone else. No, because Gio doesn't matter. But anyway, so the JoJo.
You skipped. I know there's at least a Joestar.
Probably
that
is, but then again, the Joestar, the actual Joestars that matter are every alternative generation. So, it's like Joseph. Am I right in thinking this? Joseph is like, yeah, it's really confusing. It doesn't matter.
Regardless, but it is kind of like, I think that's what people buy into, as far as I can tell, what people buy into JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is this like ridiculously epic scale, not just in the fights, but also in the timeline, that there's this centuries-long battle against various types of people.
And I also just like...
It's just an absolutely ridiculous thing. Like, it's very hyper-masculine and homoerotic, as you said. And
especially the second arc. The second arc is really, really, like, with AC/DC and cars, Mayan gods.
A lot of the characters are named after, like, metal bands and metal singers and stuff.
They're all, like, the main guy, Theo, and then I think there's one called Spice Girl, who you meet in the fourth arc. They're all named after bands. There's one called Grateful Dead, which is a really cool one. I think he brings people back to life or embodies their dead body.
I know there's a Vanilla Ice. There's a
there's Green Day. There's Westwood. There's
Oingo Boingo.
There is Oingo and Boingo. And
although in the subs on Crunchyroll, they translated them to like these weird names that made no sense. And I get that you have to hide the name, I guess, but.
That's actually a big fight in the fan sub communities. Is do you transliterate it from Japanese or do you use the band name that it obviously is trying to be?
Oh yeah, use the band name.
That's a huge. Well, apparently it's not an obvious thing. That's this huge schismatic thing of like the phonetics are not strictly Oingo Boingo. It should be whatever sort of like.
Well, that's not even it either. Like they don't even use the phonetics. They change the name completely. It's like Mondata and Tondata.
It's Zendetta and Mondiata, which is the name of the third Police album or the second. It's one of the Police albums, basically.
Oh, okay.
It's called Zendetta Mondiata. So that's where it's coming. That's where they called it.
But every time they say their names, it's like obviously Oingo and Boingo.
So and then like the weird ending song is also like completely like the bit like they say Oingo and Boingo, and it's weird. But yeah, but no, I also really like just going back to JoJo. I love the way that he's so fine with just killing off characters like they're nobody, and he does that a lot. Especially in the early seasons, it gets less and less, but it's really cool just to see shonen. It's unexpected in shonen to see people kill off characters, especially some very important ones, which is kind of rare. Mm-hmm. And also, I like the progression of the story continues. It starts third season, it goes to stands, and then it goes to something else, and then it goes to something else, and like. Stands as a concept is really interesting. It's a really cool idea. It's basically sort of like another body inside you that does powers. How do you explain stands? I don't know.
It's like a spirit like that you can summon to do things for you.
But it all starts if you see, this is the annoying thing, because then in the fourth arc it all starts when you get shot by a magic arrow, and if you survive being shot by a magic arrow, you have stand powers. And
what? Okay, because I have not, like, when I originally read the manga or tried to read it, I stopped, like, in the middle of part three, so I have no idea what happens beyond this.
Because part three is the dullest, what? For me at least, part three is the dullest arc. It's not an interesting arc.
That's weird. Isn't that, like, one of the most popular, though? If not the most popular?
Yeah, it is, because Jotaro is just a really cool guy.
Yeah.
His yada yada does it. Like, I can't be bothered. Is that an accurate translation? Oh, yeah, he's just, like, he's the coolest guy ever, and his
yada yada.
Yada yada does it. But, yeah, and, yeah, so that's why JoJo's really good. Also, like, I know you skipped the ending, the openings, Jonathan, but did you skip the opening for the end of the last episode and the episode before?
No, I actually saw that they changed it to add in the bit with Dio and JoJo, and that was fucking awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, that was so cool.
I actually stopped skipping that because I liked that song so much. Like, it was so weird at first, but then it just grew on me, and I loved it.
I really hated that song when it started off, because it's not a very good song, and they have, like... So the main thing is they say "ora," like the Jotaro shouts "ora ora ora ora," and they sort of incorporate it into the song,
yeah.
Which is kind of just a bit awkward. Like the other two, all the songs incorporate something of the JoJo sort of story into their songs. So like, but the third one is just so obviously incorporated; it's kind of awkward, and then. Like, every time I hear that ora, 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 ora bit at the end, I just kind of cringed quite badly deep down inside.
and then you became addicted to it, sounds
yeah,
like.
I mean, we just can't be asked to skip, because usually when we're watching it, we're eating, so I just can't be asked to skip the opening and just let it play out, and I guess it grew on me. It was worth it for the end bit.
Sounds like it. Well, I certainly am planning to watch it in the near future, cool. Well, is that all you're watching?
Before we get off JoJo,
God
I want to ask, what? What?
You're the one more thing guy. One more. You're
I know.
The Columbo of this podcast.
It's because I can't find a good place to interject and ask this question that has nothing to do with anything we were talking about.
Well, ask away, and then maybe we'll do Andy's game. Maybe we'll just stay here forever on JoJo.
Oh, yes. You can do, I made a game, guys, called JoJo.
All right. So... I have two things. One, I'm sick of the censoring. I don't.
Yes, do you, the censoring like, is awful.
In JoJo and in other anime like that are very violent, hyper violent, they put this really obvious solid black bar over any wound, or they like put it over JoJo smoking a cigarette at one point. But then in another episode, they couldn't do that because he like did this trick where he had like 1,000 cigarettes in his mouth at once, and that was like something that he was using.
That's
because
he's underage, so he can't smoke when he's underage. So that's a violation against some law, I guess.
Yeah, but then they have like the violent like the wound like you know, cut off an arm. You got to block all that blood. You can't let anyone see that. It's just really annoying.
Yeah, that was a Blood Sea maybe like 5 years back. Was completely ruined by censoring because they had to block like it was all huge blood sprays and they had to block like every single one of those. And it just made the show unwatchable because it was just like they actually didn't do black bars; they did like beams of light, and so just like suddenly the classroom would look like it's you know a cloud on a cloudy day and the sun's coming through because like it would just be filled with light and you'd be like oh I guess someone died I didn't get to see it, but they kind of do that also to drive Blu-ray sales too because they don't have to censor on the Blu-rays so yeah that's where you get to see it
yeah.
Especially the more etchy stuff like Bakura Tomodachi Gosukunai or any light novel. Map, they will happily censor all that stuff because they know it will be a guaranteed sale when
they can see
like a one shot of boob.
Is that true for the violent stuff too?
I assume
though?
So. Like, yeah.
No, it is. It's totally true. No, Blood Sea had an uncensored release and it sold like gangbusters, which is odd because that was a piece of crap and I hated it. It's by the guy who I tend to like stump a lot for, like. Girls and Panzer Shirobako guy, but like this was early on and he just like it was just a lot of violence. He just like basically spent 11 episodes getting to know this like school of characters, and then the 12th episode was just every character getting systematically murdered in the most unsympathetic way possible by vampires, And it was just like really hard to watch. And then he went online and he's like, great. He's like, it's okay if people don't get my, don't get this show. I didn't make it to be understood. And I'm just like, well, I don't know how I feel about that.
That's funny.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's just like in some of the earlier episodes, like in part one and part two, there were scenes where over two thirds of the, of like the scene was just a black bar and you could see like the top of somebody's head. It was ridiculous. They've definitely gotten better at like only censoring the actual wound or the actual like cigarette or whatever.
It's,
but,
man, it's such an odd choice because you're just like, I'm sure something cool is going on in this scene, but all I can see is is a corner of the room.
It's really annoying. Also, I think the JoJo anime, like they actually remaster a lot of the scenes as well. Like there was I saw a comparison of like TV release and Blu-ray release, and for the first like. For the first DVD, so it would be the first three episodes or whatever. Like, they did a lot of changes to make it look a lot better as well.
Yeah, Madoka got remastered like that when it went to Blu-ray, too. Puella, Madoka, Magica Shoujo, whatever.
Was that censored then, heavily? Because I only watched the...
It had small amounts of censoring, and also, I just think that it was a Shinbo. It was a... the director of Sino Tetsubo Sensei and Arakawa Under the Bridge. It was a Shinbo thing. I think he just wasn't happy with the budget they had. And then when it like blew up and like took over the anime world for several years, like they just had a bunch of money sitting around. So they did a remastered Blu-ray of it. And that's the one that ended up getting imported here by Aniplex. And they're okay. They're expensive because it's Aniplex. But yeah, I think it's a weird thing how like the way they drive the Blu-ray market is so different here where we sell Blu-rays usually with like, with combo deals and low prices and like a lot of internet functionality, and they just like, oh, we remastered it for the Blu-ray, oh, we took out the censoring for the Blu-ray, which is something that we don't really get here. We kind of want what's on TV to be what's on our disc.
Also, they like when they release the anime in Japan, it's like two episodes of DVD or a Blu-ray, and then
there's that too.
and then you have to pay like 50 quid for it. It's expensive.
50 quid or like $70. For our American viewers here. Okay, so overall, huge thumbs up for JoJo. Do we have a high enough thumbs up to play another one of your name games?
Yeah.
I have another question.
Okay, go. You have exactly 45 seconds.
What's up with his hat and hair? How does his hat mold into his hair? Like he when he takes off his hat, it's a normal hat, and then he puts it on, and it's like his hair is just sticking out of the back of it. And I don't know how it works. The physics.
It's called motherfucking anime.
A lot of people have asked Hirohiko Arakai that exact question, and I can't remember what the answer was, but it was something along. It just works. I honestly can't remember. There's a really great interview with, if you know the Seiyu Shokotan, I mentioned her in the first episode. Yeah, she...
You did.
She did an amazing interview with him dressed up as Jotaro and then asked him questions like, would Jotaro ever want to marry me?
I mean, I always love in when you ask authors something that's implausible about their work and they're just like, eh. Like, I remember... someone at a con like some years back asked William Gibson, like, if we have this like anti-intrusive software on the internet that like kills people and stops their heart, like, why don't you have a device that like unplugs someone automatically from the internet when their heart rate slows? And he's just like, because it wouldn't have been as interesting.
Yeah, that's like a valid defense for a weird thing in the story. I don't care.
Yeah, but...
I just think it's funny. Like, his hair is so weird. Now, speaking of hair, apparently the part four has that JoJo has a pompadour,
yes,
which I'm sold.
Yeah.
Anytime there's a pompadour.
Is it a pompadour or is it a regent? Because regents are even better than pompadours.
It's a heart-shaped pompadour.
Oh,
and
wow.
That is even brought into his backstory as to why he has a pompadour.
Oh, excellent.
It's amazing. It's amazing stuff. Fourth arc is also a really popular one because... Rohan Kishibe is in there, and he's a really popular character. He is a manga artist who has a stand called Heaven's Door, which can read people like a manga. Amazing! It's such a cool stand, and it's.
I'm getting Kuroko's basketball flashbacks from this.
There's a lot of that in JoJo. So, do you want to play my game, guys? Because honestly, It's amazing. Sure, yeah, it's JoJo based. I called it JoJo or Nojo. So basically, I've got these situations. Now, this is a bit unfair because some of these Jonathan might already know.
I'll remain silent if I do know.
Okay. I'm so ready. I am going to get myself in like a JoJo's Bizarre Adventure state of mind, and let's do this.
This is just there. So it's basically just, is this scenario, did this happen in the manga or the anime or did it not? Some of this goes past the third season, but I try to keep it spoiler free.
Sure. Okay. Possible JoJo spoilers coming up, but probably not. And they'll be funny anyway. So yeah, go ahead. Hit me.
All right. First one. One of the epic battles in the third arc is between a dog and a bird.
Yes. Yeah.
Damn it. I thought that would fool people. Well, that's just a start.
I mean, that sounds perfectly JoJo's Bizarre Adventure to me.
That's such a good fight, too.
It's such a good fight.
It's so absurd.
Oh, it's really cool. And then you feel so sorry for Iggy as well. He just wanted a hot poor bitch Iggy to marry. Genuinely, that's what he says.
Okay, let's keep this rolling. Hit me again.
One of the JoJos in the series has six testicles.
No.
Yeah,
no.
You're right, it is no. But one character does have four testicles.
Well, you don't need more than four, strictly speaking.
One of the JoJos or one of the characters?
One of the JoJos has four. In the latest one, JoJo Leone, he has four testicles, and he starts. The manga starts off with him looking in a mirror, going...
I see.
yeah.
All right, then.
does it actually, like, serve a plot purpose, though, later on?
I don't think so.
is this, like, stance?
it's just a character trait he has, like...
Okay. You know, 6 feet tall, maybe
he's
one,
also,
maybe four
he's
testicles.
Also a sailor,
maybe you're
know,
a bird.
Just as he is. With four testicles. In one particular arc, a fight is resolved by a baby being forced to eat his own poo.
Yes. Yes,
yeah,
no,
yeah,
that's it's like I've already seen the show. It's really weird.
Okay, in the seventh arc, the main story is about horse racing.
Oh, no. Really? Yeah.
No.
Oh, yes.
Well, Jonathan would be right, because it's true.
Oh, God.
It's called Steel Ball Run, and it's set with a paraplegic person who was a horse racer, has to do a race across America to win some prize to prove that he's amazing. It's more than that. It also has a guy called Giovanni who has his name Gio engraved in his teeth with metal teeth.
All right.
The amazing thing is I'm sure our viewers are just like, this sounds like the most like inanely weird show in the history of mankind. But like, you have a good time watching it. I can say that as someone who watched the first season and was like, that's all the JoJo I need for my life right now. but yeah, like you get sucked in because like it believes so earnestly in itself. And there's no like sign of like, there's no feeling that's like doing this pretentiously or that's like trying to be weird. It's just kind of like the author, whatever his name was, like believes that this is
Hirohiko.
Yes. Hirohiko Aokai like sincerely believes this is awesome. So he puts in his manga and then people read it and believe it's awesome and put it in an anime. And then you watch it and you're like, oh,
it is
okay.
Awesome. I love this shit.
Okay, one more to make an even five, and then we'll move on to, I don't know, I've forgotten all other anime. They no longer exist for me.
Okay, one more. One of the spin-off chapters revolves around a handbag with superpowers.
No.
I'm going to go with no as
yeah,
well.
Unfortunately, no. That's true.
Oh, I thought you said hamburger.
No, handbag.
Which is equally JoJo, so...
bonus points to, if you can guess who it is. Is a famous person.
I can't even start to like, there's so many people in this world.
Paris Hilton.
Unfortunately, it's Gucci. It's a Gucci handbag.
I was gonna guess Dior, but that's too close to Dior.
Gucci had a crossover promotion with JoJo in Japan.
Why can't we have like Jurassic World and Pepsi? Why can't we have Gucci in like our weird?
I know. Like, did you also see the Vivian Westwood Hatsune Miku crossover? That was interesting.
No, I don't think I'm otaku enough for you, Andy. I just watch anime. I don't like consume absolute filth off the internet.
But.
Well, I think some people will disagree hearing the description of JoJo.
Okay. John, take us away, please. Far from here.
All right. I don't know if we're gonna go far from there.
Okay. Hit me.
So let's see. The biggest thing I watched was a movie called Dragon Ball Z Lord Slug. It's not good. Don't watch it. It's a bad Dragon Ball movie. So it opens up with Gohan. I guess this is after the Saiyans. Placing it time wise is in the plot of Dragon Ball Z is difficult because it doesn't make sense. Some things have happened in the anime that shouldn't be happening in the movie. Like, Goku should be dead if Gohan's hanging out with Piccolo, but Goku's not dead. Whatever.
Side story.
Is before they ever go to Planet Namek. Anyway, that's bad. And it opens up with Gohan whistling and showing off to Piccolo his new whistle, and Piccolo gets mad. This comes back later. It's like a long sequence. It's like several minutes of Gohan just whistling with his pet dragon, and Piccolo like, shut up. it's very strange. And then Lord Slug arrives, and his whole shtick is that he's going to conquer this planet and turn it into his new spaceship so that he can fly it around the universe. And it turns out Lord Slug is a Namekian, but he still refers to himself as a demon until like halfway through the movie, at which point it's like midway through production, they realized, oh, the anime surpassed where we are now, so let's pull some stuff from that point in the anime, because before we didn't have this information. So they start talking about how he's actually a Namekian, same race as Piccolo, even though they don't know what a Namekian is at this point, and they mention Frieza, they don't know who Frieza is at this point. And then Goku goes Super Saiyan. He's never gone Super Saiyan at this point, he only does that while fighting Frieza. But Super Saiyan's not strong enough to beat Lord Slug, because Lord Slug has wished to be young again when he was his strongest with, you know, from the Dragon Balls. And then he just beats up Goku, he beats up everybody. And then it turns out, Gohan saves the day by whistling.
Oh no.
Because as Piccolo is being crushed, I think it was Piccolo being crushed by Lord Slug, he's like, Gohan, whistle! And Gohan's like, why? I don't know if I can just do it, Gohan. And then he does it, and it turns out that and then Piccolo rips off his ears because that makes him not able to hear anymore. It turns out that humans whistling is like crippling to a Namekian's ears. Like, they just can't stand it and they just go weak knees and start crying or whatever. I don't really understand. And then Goku comes back and he goes Kaioken and kicks Lord Slug's ass, and the movie ends. This is my life.
Yeah, you watched the whole thing and you didn't stop at the many points of poor continuity or just inane action. That's really impressive.
me and my friend have determined to watch all of Dragon Ball content, and I'm regretting every moment that's led up to this point in my life.
Sounds good. Sounds really good.
Don't draw.
Yeah.
Does the slug? Does he look like? I'm imagining he kind of looks like an anime version of Jabba the Hutt.
No, he's a Namekian, so he looks like Piccolo, just a bit more buff.
What?
He's like bigger, you know, wider.
Of course. Like,
that's all.
I think I know nothing about Dragon Ball, so
You don't have to know anything about it because this is terrible. I was pretty mad when we watched this movie. Like, I don't know what I'm doing
with your life.
I don't know why I exist anymore.
I mean, I'm gonna go ahead and raise like the obvious question of why is Earth a good spaceship and why not a world that has like no people on
it? I think it was just a coincidence that he happened to find this planet, but he doesn't care that there are people because he's stronger, you know, like he was able to, you know, crush them.
But there could be like, even crushing ants takes time. You could go to like Mars where there's no people and you could just fly that. Oh well, fuck it.
I think what happened was the ship, like his ship crashed into Earth, or his previous planet ship crashed into Earth.
Okay, well I'll go and we'll maybe give ourselves a break from I had a headache this morning. It's coming back from these goddamn shows. I have started watching The Disappearance of Nagato Yuki-chan, which is a spin-off of the movie The Disappearance of Haruhi Suzumiya, which
good
is
movie.
The sequel to
A+.
The two seasons that is the Melancholy of Haruhi Suzumiya, done by Kyoto Animation. I watched the first three episodes and put up one actually fairly popular live blog of watching a series based on a series I care about a lot. And just absolutely shitting all over it as much as I can, because it's dreadful. It takes the main character and replaces her with someone who's this like awful fall in love inept Mo Blob.
Can I just interrupt you? Sorry. So it's a spin-off manga, right? But it's quite successful already. Am I right in thinking this?
Yes, yes. It's got about 40-odd volumes, or 40-odd chapters.
And it's just kind of like a slice of life thing with sort of like a role change, because Haruhi's the main... Like, from my I don't know much about Haruhi. So my main knowledge is that Haruhi's the main guy, and Nagato's the Esper or something. It's just like an emotionless doll, essentially. And
Well, here. Okay, well, here. Let me go ahead and set it up all the way. So The Melancholy of Haruhi Suzumiya is an anime about a girl who may or may not be secretly a god, and the people that she ends up surrounding herself with, including this ostensibly normal dude named Kyon. And the really amazing thing about the first season, especially, but the first two seasons of the TV show, are that it's actually, it looks like a slice of life, but if you rearrange the episodes, perhaps in the way that Haruhi as a god would perceive time non-linearly, it becomes a love story where she falls in love with this guy and he doesn't realize it, and she kind of just accepts to be his friend instead. And that's what I really, really like about it, when people poop on Haruhi for like inaugurating the current like run of Kyo Annie awfulness. Like, yeah, fair enough, but it's also an excellent show on its own.
So, I mean, when I tried watching Haruhi, I guess this is what you're hinting to about the timeline. Like, there's two ways to watch Haruhi, right? There's the original airing way.
Yes, correct.
And then there's,
which is the non-chronological
way. The best way to watch it.
Absolutely,
I agree. Then there's the chronological DVD way, which I believe is the way that is actually, which is actually presented to us if you buy the DVD in your HMV or Target, whatever. Yes, sorry.
Yes, yes. And honestly, if the person has a stamina, I'd recommend watching them in chronological order first and then in airing order. But if you only have one life to watch Haruhi with, then yeah, watch it non-linearly. And actually, when I watched it the second time non-linearly, I realized that they actually have a lot of good stuff to help you realize where in the chronology you are, as long as you know that you're not in a chronological show. And in general, I'm quite fond of it. But anyway, the movie, The Disappearance of Haruhi Suzumiya, is based on one of these side characters, one of the people that becomes part of Haruhi's circle, named Nagato Yuki, who is, again, ostensibly a space alien who's come to monitor Haruhi because this alien entity is hoping to capture her power to kickstart galactic evolution or something. And she's basically a functionally humanoid robot with no emotions and no feelings, who just spends all of her time reading and not talking. And the idea in the movie is that she gradually becomes more human, which is something that we'll actually cover after the break when we talk about Time of Eve. So there's this idea that she gradually becomes more human and that she kind of falls in love with Kyon too. So actually, Haruhi's kind of a guarded or an obfuscated harem anime almost in that way. And so the spinoff manga, of course, the spinoff manga is like, what if that's actually the mainline reality of this world, is that Haruhi and Kyon aren't interested in each other, and instead Kyon and Yuki are interested in each other, and so it's this like this nice guy who is completely depersonalized for the anime and for the spinoff manga, completely like all of his notable traits of being like extremely insecure and kind of guarded against other people, that's gotten rid of. He's just like this warm, friendly potato-kun that we know from other harem anime, and falls in love with this girl who basically is just like one of the worst human beings that I've seen in an anime without like being actively evil. She just plays video games all the time. She's very like lazy and stupid and selfish and too shy to actually do anything to actually make herself happy or to make people around her happy. And we're just supposed to buy into the fact that she's like intrinsically good, and therefore we should be cheering for her as anime protagonist. And I stopped watching after three episodes because I just got really frustrated about this. And then my friend told me that actually, and this is kind of also in the manga spinoff, that actually Haruhi comes on the scene and has feelings for Kyon, the main male character, and actually acts on them. And so we have basically almost kind of the plot of the main show, but from the viewpoint of someone who is powerless in this social exchange. I'm making it sound interesting. It's not. I think that the studio is ruining it. they have these ugly generic designs that look like everyone's covered in melted butter. All the characters are just like generically nice except for Haruhi, who's just, I don't want to say something as ableist as crazy, but she's extremely unstable and unpleasant to be around. And the only really redeeming factor is that it's just that it's more Haruhi in a franchise that's not going to see any more of the mainline production because the author stopped writing novels for the anime to be based on. So there's just no ongoing profit there. It's a really cynical move, and the show's not very good. But if you're starved for more Haruhi, then you're going to watch it like I am and develop a little more self-hate thereby. So, any questions, class?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Go for it.
So there are two more books, I believe, that they haven't translated.
They adapted books 1 through 4 and parts of book 7. There are 11 books total, plus a couple of small side stories. But because the author has gone indefinite hiatus and was actually showing writer's block issues beforehand, it's pretty much assumed that the main continuity of the show is dead because you can't make any more anime without books to kind of bundle them in to sell them with, and they're just stuff that's been sitting on the shelves for the past couple of years. So then instead they're making an adaptation of the ongoing manga, which is steaming ahead. It's made by the light novel author's artist assistant, and he's garbage, honestly. It's absolutely like this really awful, awful feel-good stuff that has no idea what's good about the original show, but uses the characters for something anyway.
You know,
there's not enough content in the novels, the light novels that have not been covered.
It's not
make,
even,
like, even a movie.
We have enough to make up to 3 more full seasons of Haruhi, or 3 more half cores.
But
of
it
Haruhi.
Just
like
wouldn't provide an ending. There's no good cutoff point or anything.
There is a bit of a cutoff point, as far as I understand. I've only read the first few novels, but I think it really is just that there's no transmedia
profit.
Opportunity to sell. You can't be watch the anime and read the new light novel. They assume everyone who likes Haruhi has already bought all the light novels. Therefore, there's no reason to release more Haruhi because all the light novels have been bought.
Are the light novels translated to English, like officially, or is it
yes.
all fan translations? Oh, really?
No, they are. They are. They're like $8 or $9. Andy can provide the rubles translation.
I believe it's that would be something like £6, but I believe in England it's actually more. I think it's about £9 or £10.
When I worked at a bookstore, they had them on the shelf, and they're these tiny little things, and they're written in a really odd style. Because have you seen Haruhi, Twig, John?
Yeah, I have watched all of.
Yeah,
I've watched all of the series and the movie.
It's narrated entirely in Kyon's extremely like sardonic, distant thing, and so it's kind of an interesting read. For someone who is very aggressively putting himself forward as an unreliable narrator, because his obvious desire as narrator is not to be laughed at by you, the viewer, when telling you about these ridiculous things. And so it's actually quite good where he'll be like, and then some embarrassing stuff happened, which I'm going to skip over. I will tell you that it did not involve Miss Asahina falling on me and crying out. And it's kind of like entertainingly written like that. And it's kind of interesting because it does provide a different perspective from the anime show, which is framed by Kyon's perception, but does not happen to be this active editing that he does in the light novels. I'm sure that our listeners are going right. to, yeah, it's cool to hate Haruhi, but I'm actually
I don't hate
it. So.
Oh, I like the series a lot. To be honest, I didn't really know that there was more to it. I never bothered to research beyond. Hey, I like this series. Except for that, the Eternal Eight or whatever it's called, series
Endless
of episodes,
Eight.
That, Endless Eight, yeah, where it just fucking repeats the same shit literally for 8 episodes, except for like 5 minutes of content.
I have a friend who actually adores Endless Eight, and she's actually quite an accomplished amateur like media critic. And she's got like a essay that's been boiling forever about how just like the artistic bravery of depicting the exact same sequence of events in 8 successive episodes over and over again with slight variations and just like the amount of daring that would take.
I think it's hilarious, and it's like a massive troll at the fan base, though. It doesn't seem like something that is good. I don't know.
Yeah, well, the amazing thing is like usually you recycle you do that to save and recycle content, but everything's hand animated, like redone completely.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like the exact same 2 weeks.
That's crazy.
for 8 episodes over and over.
I feel like the animators must have gone mad just doing that over. Like, what am I doing?
I'm sure there was one guy, like, who just, like, I like drawing the same thing every day, who really dug it. But no, it drove the internet absolutely, like, into a frenzy. And I think that's actually where a lot of the Haruhi backlash comes from.
Also, wasn't the, I know I've mentioned this before, but wasn't the actor, the voice actor for Haruhi, isn't she sort of hated now worldwide for sleeping with people?
Yeah, she is hated, but she's back in they have, it's huh. entirely the same cast. So they have her back, and she's actually, like, her voice has actually changed a bit. I guess she's aging, as do all of us mortal creatures, but, like, she kind of is going to have this, like, really great, like, grandma voice in like 10 years that she'll be able to bank on. But no, she's great. They got a Yuko Goto back. If you like her, she's plays really, like, squeaky, sad, like, helpless girls, but also, like, in her private time is, like, into motorcycles and, like, fighting and stuff, and is apparently just, like, terrifying. At the in Lucky Star, near the end of Lucky Star, they actually have basically she comes on to, like, the news segment and beats up both of the news. Yeah, and that's like, literally who
that's
she
like
is.
My
it's
favorite,
voice acted by her, and
that's
she's
my favorite part of Lucky
she's
Star.
She's terrifying and hilarious.
They then crack me up all the time.
But they got everyone back, and they're all doing a good job. It's just that they're just doing a terrible script that's, like, intentionally toothless to kind of, like, if Haruhi was too weird or too aggressive, or if you, like, have weird feelings about, who is it that does Haruhi's voice?
Yeah, that sounds about
Hirano
right.
Aya Hirano. Yeah. She, like, if you hate her, like, here's, like, a much softer version that's really just plays up, like, gentle, like, quiet times together. And I don't know. I can't possibly recommend it, but I can recommend Haruhi, so I guess that's the upshot of this.
Yeah, I mean, I've always intended to watch Haruhi. I just never got around to doing it. Other things attracted my time. No, because I'm watching, like, 4 other seasons.
Well, but you've got a lot of free time now that JoJo's over, so...
I don't, and also just started watching... Oh, that's the other thing I was meant to ask. So, KyoAni aren't doing this one, right?
No, they're not. It's, I think it's Satellite. Okay. Yeah, Satellite's doing it. With, like, some, like, Kadokawa and Lantis and Clockworks, like, doing oversight. But yeah, it's a completely new studio with a director who's only he was an episode director on Gosick. He was episode director on Ungo. I've never even known that one. And he was the OP and ED director for Eureka 7 AO. And that's all he's done. He's a complete nobody. But
sorry, I was just gonna say, did you see the
go ahead.
KyoAni festival thing that they've announced?
I didn't. Tell me about it.
Kind of awful, because this is why I hate KyoAni. Like, it's Shaft and KyoAni are the two studios I really dislike, but KyoAni slightly less than Shaft, but because KyoAni sort of, like, similar with Shaft, they have their own art style, and then they stick to that for whatever they do. And unlike Shaft, who have their own style and then see other artists' style and then just ignore it completely and go with their own thing. With KyoAni, they usually attack light novels, which don't have that rigid an art style that they can really do.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, their latest thing, so it's like the, I can't remember what year, it's like 20th or 30th year of KyoAni. And so they're having a KyoAni Fest, and the promotional material is the three really big hitters of KyoAni, which is the Tamako Market Girl, the girl from Hibike Euphonium, and the girl from that other one with the red glasses. I can't remember it.
Red Data Girl, or is that?
No. It was a more recent...
Love Lab?
No, Love Lab's completely different.
I can't tell shit apart. Who am I?
I can't honestly remember what her name... It was, like, a recent anime. It was before 3, but... like, season before 3. I honestly can't remember what it's called, but it's really infuriating for me because they've got so many other better shows that they've just completely ignored in all their promotional material. It's like,
Beyond the Boundary.
Oh, yeah, that's yeah.
It. Thank okay. you. Yeah.
That's the one I was trying to think of, too. I'm glad that I was right, even if I couldn't remember the name. Go me.
Yeah.
I just, like, yeah, like, I mean, I agree with you that, like, I mean, honestly, I think the thing is I like Shaft's house style, and they've just earned unlimited goodwill for me for Sano Zetsubou Sensei. So like, that's just,
when you say you like their style, do you like their Bakemonogatari style, or like, do you like their, I mean, Arakawa all, under the bridge style?
Because I mean, they're all the same, really.
I think they're pretty significantly different.
I mean, I like their house style, and I like that they changed their house style to like be to different properties, because there are things about Sano Zetsubou Sensei, for instance, that look extremely similar to Bakemonogatari, but there's also things that are very different. I know that I can understand, like, people just don't like Shaft because it does have a very, like, it's a thick syrup over whatever property they're adapting. But Kyo Annie, like, even though I deeply, deeply love some of the stuff they do, like, again, Haruhi, like, all their latter day shows blend together to me because they all have the same damn faces and I can't tell them apart. And when you named those like three like standout girls, like Tamako Market, Hibike Euphonium, and Beyond the Boundary, like, I imagine them in my head and they look all exactly the same. Yeah. It's the three same girls.
They are sadly, essentially. But then again, like, I don't know, Kyo Annie's always got some goodwill for me because they did Nichijou, and Nichijou just doesn't look anything like their style. And I really, like...
Yeah, but Nichijou failed. It was a huge failure for some reason.
Was it? I don't understand why.
Yeah,
of course it was.
It's their fault. Yeah. They sold the first disc for 85, what ended up being about $85.
Jesus.
And it and like no one bought it. It sold like 1,400 copies. And so like this is a failure, and so it didn't get it was a huge failure, and it never got any follow-up stuff. So, which is weird because it's great. It's a latter day Azumanga Daioh with honestly a better sense of humor.
I like it much better than Azumanga Daioh personally. Mm.
I found some of the Nichijou, some of the comedy was really technically like word pun based that didn't translate very well over here, and that was a fair few of the sections were just like, I don't even understand this joke. But the bits that weren't those were, which I'm actually, for me, quite a lot. They're the bits I remember, a lot of those. But the actual parts of, like, Hakase was, that's really funny and really cool. But, yeah. So, I don't know. I just wanted to point out the Kyo Annie Live Fest thing and how they just ignore all their previous titles. And now they just...
I mean, it makes sense to promote the newer stuff, though.
Well, yeah. Also, their wholly owned stuff is what they really got in for. I think that there was a brief period it may not have continued where Kyoto Animation was like only going to make like in-house stuff adapted so that they could get all of the delicious merchandise juice out of it themselves, and that's what Tamako Market was the flagship for. I know. Do you want to take a break and then talk about Robot Cafe?
Awesome.
All right, welcome back from the break. Today, our anime of the week is going to be Time of Eve, a OVA later turned into a movie, directed, written, storyboarded, created by Yoshiura Yasuhiro, and produced by Studio Rika and Directions. Andy, I know that you had something that you just wanted to lead out with. Care to share it with the class?
Sure. The music that they played, you know, the ba 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 bum 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 ba dum bum dun dun.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. It sounded like a Donkey Kong theme tune. That's all I have.
You fucking kidding me.
Alright. And that's the episode.
Okay. Bye. Yeah. Podcast over. Okay, well, I'll go then. I'm a big sci-fi connoisseur. I'm actually doing a reading for the Hugos, because of the big scandal with the sad puppies and rabid puppies and all that, which I won't go into. But I've been doing a lot of really crunch time reading on it. And, I kind of like that this anime covers a period in our speculative future history, or even just in a imaginary moral space where robots exist. They look exactly like us unless we make them look different. And there's beginning to be kind of a like social unrest about how much they can be like us. And the idea that this anime, which involves this cafe where humans and robots, get to mingle without any sort of sign of whether they are a human or a robot. And we get to see this tension when you meet somebody. Are they real? Are they fake? What does real and fake mean in terms of people with emotions and the like? I really enjoy that the anime captures this like interesting point in robot like civil rights, kind of. It's almost kind of an allegory to like desegregation in United States schools or something, of like how do two previously regarded as separate types of beings who actually end up being quite similar in a surprising number of ways, perhaps even largely the same, and what counts, like how do these people interact and how do people deal with the idea that they're no different than something that they had previously thought of as lesser than them. So that's my profound thing to say.
That's good. Oh, can I quickly, before I have actually got something interesting.
Sure, whatever.
Say.
Whatever. Go ahead.
So Donkey Kong. No. did you guys watch the OVA or the film?
I watched the movie.
I watched the OVA first about 4 years ago when I watched the film on the excellent Kickstarted Blu-ray that was just
okay. Yeah,
was just done.
That's what I did as well.
Was done last
I
year.
Did watch the OVA a long time ago. And
I like the film a lot more. The film adds all this bookending stuff that actually gives a broader like social and historical context and within the world of the fiction, and I like that a lot more.
I could not remember the differences.
But the main difference for me, when because I watched the movie like just before we started recording. Like, because I've watched the OVA twice, I think. I really enjoyed it, but the main sticking point was the actual barista. There's no indication of whether she's a robot or a human. And then in the film, they make it.
This is a bit of a spoiler, by the way. This is a bit of a spoiler. Go ahead.
No,
Spotlight animes get spoiled because we want to talk about them through and through, so go ahead.
Cool. Well, it's very explicit that she's actually part robot or part human. She's part both. At the very end, like after the credits roll, there's a scene with that robot dad, and then you put her hand, and then you can see her hand sort of like half, sort of like segmented, and then you also see the ending cutscene. There's a whole bunch of pictures.
I thought that was his hand.
That's his hand, yeah.
It's his hand, but then she puts her hand on top of it. And then if you look very closely, you can see the segments in between between her fingers and her knuckle. You can see just a little... Just, so she's like an advanced version of what of him, essentially.
I see.
I mean, I thought the implication was, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, and this is what I liked a lot about the movie versus the OVA, is that they have this sort of thing that this... there's the background to this anime movie is this virulently like anti-robot group called like the Human Ethics Committee or something.
Which despite sounding official is
functionally just like a moral majority like anti-robot group that they had lost influence some years ago because of an incident where a human girl was hurt while they were trying to destroy robots because the human girl was protecting the robot. And they're gaining power now again during this movie, and that's why the business is threatened, the cafe that lets humans and robots intermingle. And that I thought the implication was that the revelations that Nagi, the bartender, is the human girl who was hurt, and she was rehabilitated by one of the major creators, who they talk about like Sugitaka or whatever.
Yes, but she's also part robot. So she's actually sort of a combination of both a human and a robot. One of her arms is part robot, I think she loses it. It's sort of, she loses it in the fight. That's the damage that it's done to that little girl.
Yes, yes. But instead of her being this really mysterious character in the OVA, I kind of enjoy the fact that we, even though mystery is almost always better to be preserved in a fictional work, especially a work of speculative fiction. But I do really enjoy that we get to see her background. We see that, like, the figurative midwife of this like human robot coexistence is this girl, who experienced firsthand the effects of like anti-robot hate, and so that's why she's so committed to these rules, which several of the other characters, especially the protagonist and his friend, regard as extremely stupid and completely pointless, and they transgress them constantly, and that we see that. Instead of her being like childish with like why why keep up the charade that humans and robots are the same when they're so obviously different. We see why she pushes so hard for that.
Yeah. I feel that the, like, they regard it as stupid at the beginning, but then I feel by the halfway point, he takes them, one of the main characters, I can't remember who the main guy is, he definitely takes it on point to be as sort of accommodating to that rule as possible, right?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, I think when the, was it like Karotan or whatever, Kataran, the defective robot walks in.
That was so funny. Mm. And sad.
And I kind of want to talk about, because it, like, they play it for laughs, and then within like 30 or 40 seconds, it slams into, like, oh, this is like this tortured creature that, like, has this intense feeling for someone who, like, cast him aside in the most callous way, and then he dies on screen, and it's just, and it was, it reminds me of how uneven, didn't even remember the tone being this uneven in the OVA version, but maybe that's because the episodes allow for a bit different emotional swing. But the movie goes back and forth between like, oh, goofy robot antics, or something, and just like almost everybody, especially the two main characters, but like everyone in this room is hiding some sort of intense trauma. And they go to this place where these things causing their trauma, the difference between robots and humans, where that trauma can't exist because the differences that cause it aren't allowed to be spoken about. And I enjoyed it a lot more the second time. I thought of it as a trifle the first time I watched it, but this time I got a lot out of it.
Yeah, I like the juxtaposition of robot antics versus, you know, the serious moments. Like, another good example was near the end when Tex and Masakata, the not main character.
Masaki Masakazu, which is a really unfortunate name to give your kid.
Masakazu, okay.
Don't use the same sounds for first and last name.
But anyway, when he was talking to Tex, and Tex was like, you know, they finally got back in touch with each other through words, and then it's like, let's go home, Tex, and then text can't go up the stairs.
Yeah.
he just like, it's just really slow, like melancholic music, and then just boop, and music stops. It's really good. That was a good moment. I liked it because it sort of emphasizes the difference between humans and robots, and then at the same time, like, they're still, you know, close, and that's cool. Mm-hmm. I like that about the anime movie, whatever.
Yeah. Do you want to say, I was the one, the actual other thought that I had, because I did mention I had two, was, so the name Eve, like, this must be a Bible reference, right? I was going to use a fancy word, but I forgot what it happens to pronounce.
Biblical
reference. So was this something to do about that Eve was made for Adam's bones and was then made to serve him? I guess, is that just me being a really idiotic, like, is that obvious to you? Or because I just realized it, basically.
I mean... Do you have something you want to say, John, or should I just go in to start gumming on this in the most impotent way possible? Like, I actually thought a lot about this. The first time, I kind of just like, oh, it's the Evangelion effect of like a foreign religion. It just seems more exotic. But then again, there's like the joke where she calls their coffee instead of like the Eve blend. She's like, it's Eveland. And they finally are just like, oh, sure. I do think it's the idea. It's, at the very least, it's kind of harkening generally back to this, like, this garden of Eden before man knew good and bad, before man knew that he was different from the animals, and before everything had a name, this idea of this, like, kind of inchoate prehistorical. And I don't mean that in terms of like Lucy and like Homo habilitus. I mean that in terms of like, before history even existed, this like pre memory time when everything just existed together, unmixed, undifferentiated. But I think it also, I don't know how far we want to go into, but I think you are right to mention that, like, yeah, it is like the idea of that Eve was made from Adam, but they were equals, or at least in certain denominations and confessions, they're equals. But no, I wonder about like a lot of the symbolism there, because they have a lot of drops, like the protocol that protects the cafe is protocol 1138, which is a THX 1138 reference.
Oh man, but, I didn't see that.
Which I don't.
Oh, and Tex's name is actually THX.
Yeah. Which I don't particularly think it lands, because it's about a dystopian future where like android police control emotion and suppress sexual desire, and this is the androids are not the caretakers of society in this case. But I don't know. Anyway,
I mean, they sort of are, but then also mostly it's like the ethics committee are afraid that's what's going to happen, right?
Well, you could sleep with sexy robots, right? I mean, that's what everyone's thinking, right?
Yeah, there's this very like the tomato being crushed and only gears come out. I think I felt it was over repeated as the like background to various city scenes, but I do think it's a very effective image of this idea of something that looks organic and looks nourishing, but inside is only metal and gears and oil.
Yeah, I actually wrote down like, yeah, that's the next level of the organic versus factory farm sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I didn't quite understand that message, because they say something like, you wouldn't want a tomato made by a robot. You're just like, well, I mean, it's still a tomato. Like, it's just grown by a robot. I don't know.
Or is it? Does it have gears?
Yeah. Well, I think the idea is, and we get a hint of this when in one of the later scenes where Masaki's talking to his dad, and his robot brings in Tex brings in a plate of like food and tea, and his dad's like, oh, you don't want that you don't want them preparing your food, you can't really trust them. Mm. He says something like that, and he's the head of the ethics committee, so like this idea that robots could be programmed to poison you. Which is very odd, because he later uses the robot to type up his notes about like doing basically Gestapo raids on all underground human robot cohabitation. He trusts the robot for that. Mm. But there is this idea that's kind of vindicated in the movie that you can't know what robots are thinking, and that we don't know if they choose to appear human, or if they are human, or if they are more than human, and are kind of like confine themselves down to a more humanoid form, that we have this ambiguity. Because very early on, what's the girl's name, the first one that we discover is actually a robot, like Akiko.
Yes.
Akiko, where she's just like, I just want to know how the other half lives. And they're like, oh yeah, I mean, who knows what robots are thinking, they've got weird like machine brains. And it's like, oh no, she wants to understand people better, like she wants to get closer to figuratively speaking her creators, and that's why this is a special place for her. The two lover robots who get to like experience human love because they live in a tension where one doesn't know that the other is robotic, and they both are. At the end of the day, we have the young girl who's like robotic caretaker grandpa dude is can basically just like act normally around her, because he doesn't have to have that halo.
Yeah,
shaping the reactions.
Yeah.
He doesn't even have to have that sort of barrier, because she's a kid and she doesn't understand it. Like,
she's a cat.
She's a cat. Sorry, she's a cat.
She's a cat.
I always get that mixed. That kid. Did it sound like it was actually a child voice actor who was doing that?
Well, I'm looking at the voice actress's page now, and it's Sawashiro Miyuki, who is 29 years old. No, she just turned 30.
Right. Okay.
So no, she
very convincing.
From Arakawa Under the Bridge, she was Maria.
Oh wow!
So yeah, she actually plays mature. She was the helmeted motorcycle rider in Da Ra Ra Ra.
Oh, Selty Sörlesen.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow, that's quite a range.
She also does like, she has weird voices too, because she's the Logicomas in the new Ghost in the Shell series, Arise, and she in again Sanrio Zetsubou Sensei, she does Maria Taro Sakitsu, like the foreign immigrant girl who talks really weird. So she just apparently just has a huge, incredibly huge range. Mm. She either plays like sexy mature women. Oh, sorry. Even better, she's Ginko from Mushishi.
What? What?
I think we should be making a fan page of her. She's got like an incredible range. My God,
that's insane.
What? That is pretty good.
Yeah, she plays a big range. She plays dudes. She plays kids. She plays robots. She plays like mature, sexy women. She
plays Del Hallen. Spoilers for Do That Other, but whatever. Find out pretty early on. But yeah.
Anyway, so she apparently is just like a superstar. That's who she is.
She's everybody.
But no, like, actually, like, I did want to say, and this is my thing, is that like the voice talent on display here is unbelievably huge. Mm. Like, these are all huge names. Tanaka Rie, Sato Rina, Fukuyama Jun or Yun Jun Ito Miki, like these people are big ass names, and yeah, it's that... a guy who mostly does like little kind of indie films ish.
Yeah, his previous one was Aquatic Language, right? Which is essentially the same thing, but in the bar stuff, lady was actually just a robot on like a winch.
Well, his most recent, actually, he just made Patima Inverted, which is this weird world where everyone lives in tunnels, and some people live on the ceiling of the tunnel, and some people live on the floor.
Yes, and I've seen that.
That just came out, and that's, I haven't seen it yet, but my friend saw it at a film festival and loved it.
Oh no, maybe I've seen the short of it.
There's a short that just came out a
couple of years ago.
About early 2012.
Yeah, that's what I've seen.
But before that, he made Pale Cocoon, which was this incredibly somber and depressing short, 23 minutes long, about a guy working in an archive, like during a nuclear winter. Like he's in a missile silo. And he's working at just preserving data as one of like these last fragments of humanity. And like, he's friends with this girl who is kind of has a like weirdly like Thanatos death wish about like the surface, and what happened to humanity. And like, I would recommend it, and it's on the Blu-ray and it's easily found on YouTube or Hulu or something. But before that was Aquatic Language in 2002, Pale Cocoon was in 2005.
So there's I was part of an anime society, and every beginning of every year, I always brought in Pale Cocoon because I really love it. And every year, somebody spoils the ending before it gets shown, and it's just like, oh, for fuck's sake, guys, come on, just hold your horses, just shut up for 10 minutes.
Well, if it's any consolation, I've never heard of it or seen it, so
it's really good.
I can watch it.
I would watch it. If you have the Blu-ray, apparently, yeah, it's on the Blu-ray. Aquatic Language and Pale Cocoon are on there, and I love Pale Cocoon. It's in a world where we're really obsessed with this really like violent and kind of just like outlandish apocalypse, just a sort of like world where like people are working on computers to like salvage what's left of society is really, it's a grim look, but I enjoyed it a lot.
And it also felt like it was something that, I don't know, hasn't really been like that before, just the way that he's just meticulously going through essentially one file, just trying to match everything together, and yeah, really, really good. Definitely worth a watch.
Yeah, apparently he just released a few months ago, released a new show called a new short, 25 minutes long, called Harmony, about a guy who like gets inside a like discovers like what's going on with this girl in the classroom. It seems much more conventional, but then again, we've seen clearly from his previous work that he's not a particularly conventional person, so...
Yeah. Oh, that reminds me of one thing about Time of Eve. I'm doing a twig here, but the camera angles are really interesting in that, because it sort of moves all over the place and then does sort of, like, 180 sweeps and sort of... It revolves in a really odd and interesting way that you don't see in a lot of anime, I find.
The rail focus they often do like a rail focus out to all the stuff that couldn't be done in real life. But yeah, I agree.
And it felt very cinematographic as to sort of current live action stuff that is really interesting. And I feel that's partly because a lot of it is sort of like the Time of Eve, the actual cafe felt CG, and then the mix of CG and hand-drawn stuff was really well done to a point in which it was kind of hard to differentiate, or not differentiate, but it wasn't as glaringly obvious as a lot of other anime.
Yeah, like the broken robot, the old one, like that was obviously CG, but it didn't bother me like it usually does. Like usually that stuff is so glaring and I just hate it.
I think that like the fact that everything's got a little bit of CG, and oftentimes, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like there's oftentimes like a feeling of lag in a lot of scenes with lots of motion. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but there's just a bit of like discrepancy between like the sounds and the motion and oftentimes the background that has this kind of like...
I noticed that too, but I wasn't sure if it was because my computer just couldn't handle 1080p.
I watched it on a Blu-ray player, and I think it's intentional. It was there in the OVA too.
Like during the fast sweeps sort of thing.
I think that it's almost like intentional that he wants you to be conscious of the computerness of it as like a kind of a futuristic touch. That might be me going into like really out there film critic mode. But I do think that there, there is this like futurism that he conveys through the use of computer animation.
Yeah. Also, the going back to that robot, I think that because he's an old build, the fact that he's so obviously CG really works, because then it's so is just a juxtaposition between sort of the current robots, which just look like humans, and these old robots that are just so clearly, blatantly sort of exoskeletons and jittering about and shit.
Mm-hmm.
Any other anything else?
No, I don't know if I have anything else, unless Jonathan, do you have any other last comments?
Maybe I do.
I mean, I feel you sort of you sort of brushed over my Donkey Kong comment, right?
I did, because it was
it was just too true. I didn't feel it deserved it.
Let me watch me try to salvage it. Okay, so like the like the idea that he stops playing because he plays alongside this android, and like kind of like it feels like he feels the future coming to him, that like he can be as good as he wants and the robot will still get the front page story, and that makes him stop. He doesn't stop playing because of that, but he stops playing in front of robots, and so he stops playing entirely. And so to hear him come back in his triumphal return to this, to the piano, is what I thought of as like a decently good like medley piece that doesn't particular, that's kind of mostly sold by the camera angles and the mood lighting and the expression on characters' faces. I wondered what exactly we were supposed to take from that in terms of like whose perspective are we seeing this from? Are we seeing this from the perspective of his robot Sammy, who apparently is just completely enamored with his playing, and it's somewhat implied that she sought out like the time of Eve in order to like find a place where she could express this like love of art, and his art especially. Even though the music itself is not particularly impressive, I guess for a guy who hasn't been playing for, you know, 3 or 4 years, it's something. There, how is that?
I don't know. Well, actually, talking about that, because I got away from that, but he was not worried that the robot will get the main headline, but that if he played in front of robots, they will get as good as he is. Because he said, like, he didn't hate the robot for playing. He hated the robot because the robot was really good at playing. And I felt that, like, I don't know, I was kind of maybe hoping that they would sort of bring in this sort of, like, soul aspect, like, yeah, but, you know, like, there's no soul in this sort of android music.
No, I love that, actually. They did bring it up because his friend's like, oh, but it was precise, nothing more. And he's like, no, I felt something. And I really like that, because it completely subverted this idea that like, oh, robots can be good, but they can never capture the soul. Like, what scared him is that the robot made him feel something when he played, gave him an emotional reaction to robot playing. And he felt it feels like at that moment he felt obsolete, or at least, as you said, threatened by it. I enjoyed that a lot, because I was expecting to be like, oh, well, like you said, like, oh, they can never capture the soul of the music. But, like, no, the robots can, because they're people. That's what this show's all about, is that, like...
Yeah, and I really like that. Like, in a lot of this kind of speculative robots are turning into humans sort of fiction, it's a lot more pessimistic and, like, you know, doom and gloom. Like, yeah, they're going to take over someday and there's nothing you can do about it. But I liked how optimistic this was about, like, just learning to live with these beings that we've created sort of thing. Like... compared to other recent fiction, I don't want to name because it would directly spoil it, but it's really nice. I like optimistic science fiction. It's so nice to see that.
I mean, and
so much of it is just pessimistic.
It exists in a pessimistic world where there's an extremely powerful like consumer advocacy or civilian advocacy group that's just like wrecking stuff.
Definitely, but the message, the overall message of it is, that's okay.
Yeah, like we can wait these people out. Yeah, I agree, and I like that.
Yeah. But on the other hand, robots are going to destroy us all.
That's true. We're ultimately doomed. Oh, yeah, also, like, the mum talks really, like... It kind of annoys me, because the mum talks really friendly to the robot, like it's an actual person. But then, like, the generation that below it, just... the main guy gets really embarrassed talking to the robot. But, if anything, it's just, like, commands. And then, like, because I guess he's pressured under the pressure of being considered a... Was it Dorike?
Dorike is what they called it.
Yeah, well, I don't know why the mum wouldn't. I I don't know, maybe it's just like a generational thing they're trying to prove.
Was it the mom or the sister that you're talking about?
The sister mocked would mock him whenever he was too close. No, it was the mom was there in the early scenes and vanished later on.
Oh yeah.
Mom, the mom is the one who like gives her, like she mentions like the mom gives him her clothes and like hairband and does her hair.
Yeah, I remember.
I like that idea that like it's also kind of like a dilemma for a young person, because like an older person, they're just like, yeah, just give them the parts, like who cares? And it's only these select group of people who are kind of upset. Like he is very much like embarrassed when they're sharing an umbrella, when like it's something that other people wouldn't care about, because who cares if like you don't want your robot to get wet? They're not made to get wet. Surely they're not made to get wet.
His peers cared, and that's what I feel was important for him. But for everybody else, I'd just be like, yeah, whatever. Yeah. But then again,
I think he would have been fine with it if it weren't for the fact that other people were judging him doing that, like sharing an umbrella in Japan, right? That's like a very romantic thing. Right?
Yeah. But also
has romantic connotations.
Yeah. Also, I guess there might have been a reflection on just like Japanese culture and how sort of set in these stringent sort of rules that, oh, you can't be doing this. You can't be seen holding your hands with a girlfriend unless you're on Christmas, because then you're sort of being too forwards. And like the idea that everybody in Japan is judging you in one way or another, could be that. I don't know. But
it's interesting in a much more like external like shame society. Like how do robots come into play, as opposed to like, I mean, I feel like there's an assumption that like in the West we'll just like we'll be selling sex bots because of course, and the idea that like. That like you have the right to what you want with your own property versus like there's a social responsibility in how you treat what you own is definitely something that makes this, I think, probably a little bit more uniquely Japanese in taking hold of the problem.
I think the only other anime that I watched that had like a lot of these issues was Chobits, which was not a good one. That one was like the on-off switch on that robot was in her private area.
There's the Dressrosa arc in One Piece or something similar.
I was I think a lot of I mentioned, I promised this to someone on the forums, that I talk about Ergo Proxy, and I don't have much to say except that also is concerned about like about what happens if robots feel, how do we exist in a world where there's humans, post-humans, and robots. But I don't actually I think that one of the big flaws of Ergo Proxy included, not to mention like a mid-season slowdown that's really egregious, but one of the big flaws.
I haven't seen Ergo Proxy. That's the I think I've seen the pictures of it. That's like the one.
I'm sure you've seen it because it's got a smoking hot goth girl on the front, and yes,
I can't remember the singer that everybody calls her.
From Evanescence, yeah.
That's it, Evanescence. Yeah, it looks like Evanescence anime, but I know nothing about it.
But no, it's about she's part of this like elite society. In these domed cities after an apocalypse, and they use robots to take care of most like civic and daily needs. And the problem is that like the robots are going crazy, and they have this, like, it's called the Cogito virus, where robots gain self-awareness and immediately try to kill people. And like what the broader implications of that are. But it doesn't actually go as weirdly, despite being a much longer show, much, much longer. Then Time of Eve, it doesn't go into the implications of like what happens when the robots inevitably become sentient or recognized as people. It's much more interested in the kind of the tension of in the society where the definition of human or not human or more than human is breaking down. I overall recommend it, but I don't think it covers the idea of like robot rights as effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there you go, Sin. I told you all about Ergo Proxy, and you're welcome. So, you guys want to wrap it up? I think we're hitting just past 90 minutes, and we've probably tired everyone out, especially if we're going to be talking about Donkey Kong and Amiibos and all this other unapproved stuff. Contraband.
I'm sure.
Until they start making Amiibo that are anime characters, and you'll have to let us talk about it.
If there's a Fire Emblem anime, I'm watching the shit out of a Fire Emblem anime. Right now,
yeah,
I feel like there is no
Fire Emblem anime. I guarantee.
There's an F-Zero anime. It's an F-Zero anime. Just pretty. Just where.
Oh, and there's a Captain Falcon amiibo. There we go.
I was wrong. There is a Fire Emblem OVA made in the mid '90s. It has really? a rating of 6.05 on my anime list, which probably means it's pretty terrible.
It's just generic as eggs. Just people.
Looks like Record of Lodoss. I'll just watch Record of Lodoss War again if I want to watch like batshit mid-90s fantasy.
What was that?
Man, I did not like Record of Lodoss War.
Record of Lodoss War is an anime that he wrote some of Japan's first homegrown fantasy novels based on his Dungeons & Dragons campaign, and then those were made into an anime. And the amazing part of Record of Lodoss War is all, if you've ever played a pen and paper role-playing game, and you know how people like act out of character or just like are terrible to each other because they're greedy or because they're stupid or because they don't want to do something, it's all preserved in the anime. So you have people like, slight spoiler, the main character hides throughout most of the final boss battle at the end of the show. He hides and cries. I love it. It's such garbage. And yet it's completely seminal despite that. Anyway, well, let's wrap it up for today. Yeah. This has been Keyframes. We have an email and a Twitter account now. The email, where we'll love if you can send us some questions, is keyframespodcast@gmail.com. Our Twitter account, where you can see us tweeting probably when we release the show, but also maybe cool anime stuff too, is @keyframespod, as in the first half of podcast. So we'll see you in a couple weeks when we'll be talking about something probably not sci-fi. We're on a bad sci-fi run, aren't we? I have been your host, Ben Halliburton. Say goodbye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.
I have another question.